We're going to stop sharing and we're going to start. I'm going to mute the other two people's video so that I'm the one that's shown. Welcome to session 161. Thank you for attending the 2020 Digital Sunstone Symposium, sessions 161, titled Coffee, Alcohol, Cannabis, Psilocybin, Ayahuasca, Navigating Substance Use After Mormonism. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning at the end of August 2020. The question and answer during this session, there will be more of a formal question and answer at the end of the session. However, Jeff and Jennifer have agreed that if there are questions relevant to the discussion, that I will kind of interlace them through the conversation. So don't think that you need to wait till the end of the session to ask your questions. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, when transitioning Mormons begin to question the validity of the Word of Wisdom, many begin to explore and experiment with previously forbidden substances. Some have positive experiences, but not all. This presentation will address substance use from a mental health perspective, addressing common pitfalls, and offering strategies for exploring the use of coffee, alcohol, cannabis, psilocybin, ayahuasca, and more. The presentation will not focus on legal issues, but rather on the medical and psychiatric applications of these substances. So when you're asking your questions, let's not worry about legal stuff. Let's just worry about medical and psychotropic effects on the body. Jeff has received an undergraduate degree in psychology and a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. He works as a therapist in the Salt Lake City area. Jeff serves a variety of individuals with a focus on faith, relationships, marriage, anxiety, depression, trauma, and men's issues. Jennifer White is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in helping people with depression, anxiety, and sexuality concerns, trauma and faith transitions and journeys. I will now give the floor to our presenters. So I'm going to ask to start video. And I will unmute you and unmute you. And I will mute myself.
Thank you. I'm going to share out the presentation that we have as we go through this. So welcome, everybody. This is an interesting topic. I think of all of the boundaries that surround what a Mormon faith transition looks like, how people engage and experience substances is probably one of the interesting ones for sure. So as an introduction, this presentation is largely going to focus on faith transition and substance use, not necessarily substance use in and of itself, and not necessarily faith transition as a topic by itself. From a legal disclaimer perspective, all the information that we're sharing right here does not condone any illegal activity or even unethical use of any substance. This is just information you should consult with your health provider or, you know, the legal restraints within, you know, wherever you live. We did not include three drugs in particular. Methamphetamines as a class, we really didn't. Crystal meth and heroin, largely because there's really not a whole lot of value in those drugs. There are some exceptions. I recognize that.
Well, and in my experience, you know, I've led a lot of substance abuse groups for many years. Jeff and I have even done that together. And there's not a lot of redeeming value in meth and heroin. That tends to be a lot more problematic in people's lives.
Sure.
That's just what I see clinically.
Absolutely. So we didn't include them just to keep the definition or the scope of what we're trying to research on or study and report. Just a couple definitions. When we're talking about substance use, we're talking about the consumption of a drug. A drug really is from our perspective in today's conversation is not pharmaceuticals as much as it is just a thing. Faith transition, just the navigation of one's belief, and particularly within the Mormon umbrella. And we didn't really define the scope of what that is. We recognize the term Mormon may be out of favor with some, but we're going to use that term today. So we're not going to go into a lot of detail on the mechanisms of actions behind the substances that we will talk about. They're in the slides as a point of information. But the substances that we will discuss to some degree are alcohol, cannabis, ayahuasca, peyote, cocaine, which you think, well, cocaine doesn't have, how's it different than heroin? Well, I don't know. People mentioned it, right? They mentioned it in the other, so we put a category for that. LSD, mushrooms, caffeine is a classification. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on caffeine, which I'll explain in a moment. Tobacco and ecstasy. So there's some details behind all these. They all work differently. There's some similarities, of course. So in kind of diving into what the approach that we took, again, we're taking the intersection between faith transition and substance use. We had Jen and I put together a survey with 324 respondents. Is it statistically significant in some areas? No, we recognize that, but it really wasn't done for that purpose. I'll try to point out areas where I think if it's relevant that there may be some shortcomings in that area. I wish we did a non-Mormon respondent population set, because we don't have a lot of comparison, so we're making some assumptions in that way. And I wish we had more believing or active Mormons in the survey that we did, again, for the purpose of contrasting, but we did have a number of them. There were a few demographic questions that we asked just so that we could break apart the questions themselves. And we didn't really dive into a lot about caffeine and coffee, mostly because it's so widely used, right? Even between, you know, the active Mormon with, I got my Diet Coke every day versus I drink coffee and I'm very inactive, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and plus, I mean, one of the things that we were really interested in is how people are using substances for spiritual reasons. And that caffeine is probably, at least I use caffeine to normally get myself to get more stuff done.
Right. The productivity drug. For sure. So we'll kind of cover some high level results out of the survey that will introduce the core of where we really want to go here. Again, these are the substances that we reported. Alcohol by far was the most popular used substance. No big surprise, right? It's legal. It's available.
Yeah. It's definitely a lot easier to get and legal and...
Sure. Cannabis came in number two, again, probably because it's legal in most areas now. Hallucinogenics, we collapsed these. That would be peyote, LSD, ayahuasca, and psilocybin, because it made more sense as we collapsed it in how they're used. Cocaine and MDMA, again, we combined them because those are similar in how they're applied, not exactly, but similar enough. Tobacco, and then people would say, well, I haven't really tried any of those things. Anyway, some high level here. Why did people use what they did? The biggest category was social. And beyond that, we've got a smithereen of exploration, physical or mental health, emotional reasons, and then spiritual enlightenment, which is kind of going to be the two fork in the road. It's like people using some of these substances for more spiritual connection in some way, or in some social or physical mental kind of way.
And this is one of the things I found most interesting, and we'll get to kind of dive into it a little bit later a little bit more, because
for sure
it's fascinating.
What benefits did people experience? Notice that the highest category was fun, pleasure, social connection. As you would imagine, again, maybe because alcohol is the most widely used, and alcohol is predominantly used for that reason. Healing, number two, psychological, number three, and then spiritual enlightenment, number four, and everything else. It's kind of interesting that the details behind these, I think, are more helpful. What kind of challenges? Now, I will comment on this one. None. Most people have no challenges whatsoever.
Yeah, this is, well, I mean, even there's a lot of research with this where most people that use substance abuse, you know, don't become addicted. I think it's like 8 or 9% of people that do. So there's kind of two truths there to look at. Like, yeah, people can use things without problems, especially single use doesn't normally lead to addiction. You want to be careful if there's genetic issues, like in your family, that biological component is important. But also on the other side, like even if it's just 8%, that's a lot of people. So you also want to be careful with that. But one of the things I like about this is it takes some of the stigma away.
Right. It's that there can be a successful path in which people experience substance use.
Yes. It doesn't, it's not always problem. It can be non-problematic rather than problematic.
Correct. So as we went in to look at some of the details, this was interesting. When we organize the respondents by belief and activity, there's two things that come out. In general, believing members and or members that participate in some way, either semi-active or active, their use of substances pivot around two things primarily: emotional regulation or physical health in some way, right? Pain management is an example with cannabis, could fall in that category. But if you tend to be non-believing or more inactive, then we see more use, or we see more purpose around social connection, spiritual enlightenment, recreation, or exploration. Any thoughts there, Jen?
Not right now.
Okay. We have so much content. It's like we can spend hours on this stuff.
Yes.
Well, what about which substances are being used by both believing and non-believing Mormons? What our survey results show is that when somebody has any kind of a belief, that the substances that they're drawn to are the ones that are more socially acceptable. Alcohol, cannabis in many areas, even psilocybin as a psychedelic is far more accepted among believing Mormons than is ayahuasca, LSD, or, and I'm going to say even peyote at the bottom. We just didn't have a whole lot of peyote respondents, so I'm not sure that that's statistically reliable. But it is interesting to note that when people believe, right, then they're going to turn to commonly socially acceptable things, including tobacco, right? That would be more commonly accepted. But this other stuff, it's like that's more nefarious, that's more, you know, dangerous. So we're just not going to go there because we believe. Let's see. Age is interesting. When we group the age of our respondents together, there's a couple things that stand out. People that are younger tend to use substances more for exploration, social reasons, or recreation. When people are old, our older populations, which is 55 and up, that's what we've bracketed as being older. It's a common question. They actually use it for social reasons. And Jen and I were talking about this, and while we don't have any qualitative data, it's kind of like the, hey, we get together for a glass of wine with our friends, that kind of thing. Who uses it for spiritual enlightenment? Middle age. That 35 to 54 range, that's where we see people using hallucinogenics.
And that does line up with the data that we know about just faith transitions and when people are really questioning and reframing and finding other ways to be spiritual, you know, in their own powerful ways. And so I thought it was interesting that it did line up with the literature on that.
Yep. Again, I wish we had more respondents that were older, but our age breaks actually were consistent with a demographic representation.
You guys, there actually is a question that goes along with that. I'm going to cut in and ask a question. Mormon faith crisis is accompanied by a world collapse wherein the enchantment breaks open and leaves the person feeling flat and two-dimensional. Could it be that imbibing is really about re-enchantment and a replacement of the magic?
I think the answer is yes, absolutely it could be. For sure. And we're going to touch base on that a little bit when we talk about, you know, Mormon-specific things that we observe. And I think that's one of them. It's just creating a larger fulfillment through the use of certain things.
I love that question. That's a very good thought-out question. Yeah. And yeah, definitely.
We also noticed that people that have previous experience with substance use they're more likely to turn to more taboo labeled substances. Ayahuasca, cocaine, right? MDMA. They're more apt to do that. I think that's, we talk about gateway drugs, or, and I don't even like that term, but
there are different theories about this, you know, and but there is that gateway theory. There's another theory I kind of like a little bit better, but it does make sense that, like, when you first try things, that you're going to use things that you have more access to, before maybe some of the others.
Correct. This is interesting. Common challenges versus or intersecting purpose with emotional regulation. In other words, the people that use substances for emotional regulation, think anxiety, depression, trauma, things like that, they're the ones that experience the problems.
Yes. Yeah. And definitely with my clients, that's when I get a little concerned. Are people using something to numb their emotions? And when you're using it, and there's issues, I think it's much better to explore those in therapy, you know, and really understand some of those rather than just going to numbing. Also, medications can be so helpful with mental health issues, but particularly with mental health issues when there's a doctor that's kind of overseeing it, so it's not abused, that can be very, very helpful, I think.
For sure. So kind of interesting thing. And then, of course, the flip side is if people aren't using it for emotional reasons, they're primarily using it for some of these other things, they're really not as problematic as people would think, certainly within a Mormon, you know, narrative. Let's see, purpose by substance. So why are people using what they are? Well, there's a lot of commonality with some exceptions. Spiritual enlightenment, people are turning to substances that promote those spiritual experiences, or those transcendental experiences. I'm just trying to think of the right word there. They're using ayahuasca, they're using psilocybin, they're using peyote, those types of things for spiritual enlightenment. But in other areas, it's pretty broad, right? With maybe the exception of alcohol for physical health. Again, probably not the best choice, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to see how alcohol use is very socially motivated or very recreational motivated. Where we find the exploration here, I think it's the Mormon thing. I don't think that Mormon or individuals outside of a Mormon population as adults use alcohol to explore, probably because they explored when they were younger. That's my guess. The only gender.
Go ahead. Kimberly, did you have something to chime in?
Well, I'm trying to decide if this question is relevant or if it's not, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it is pretty interesting. Did you find, and I know this is kind of outside of the scope of your research, but did you find any grounding behind the theory that entheogens, wow, how can I cannot say that word? Entheogens were involved in the early revelatory experiences of Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
It's been floating around for a while.
Yeah. We all have a whole slide just for that. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's see, gender. The only thing that stood out with gender was women from our data will have a tendency to use substances more for psychological or physical healing more than men. I'm not sure if that's true exactly, but that's interesting, at least within a Mormon population. Any thoughts on that, Jen?
I can definitely see with healing, you know, a lot of women are, and I hate gender stereotypes. Before I say this, I really, really think they're very problematic. So take this with a grain of salt. But often women are open to finding other ways of healing and not just the traditional medicine, maybe Eastern medicine, and some of these things are maybe a little bit more outside the box. Sometimes the spirituality too. But again, men and women are more similar than different, and we have to be careful with stereotypes.
For sure. Okay. I don't know how much I want to go through all these points because I think we've got more important things to talk about. It was interesting to notice the challenges that social and monetary impact were the highest when you measure real real cost, right, or real challenges.
Well, and I mean, alcohol is really expensive.
It can be.
This is not cheap.
For sure. So cost is definitely an issue. 70% of our respondents had no previous experience. That seems high to me. And it's probably because they're Mormons.
But yeah, with the Mormon population, people often don't try things until maybe they're questioning.
Sure. Yeah. There was an interesting data point where people seeking spiritual enlightenment were on two extremes of the activity spectrum. They were either very inactive or they were very active. But they weren't on the fence, as it were. I don't know why that is. Jen and I talked about this. I think it's because when you're in the middle of a faith transition, you're probably more cautious about what you do or don't do, or who you do things or don't do things with. But if you've transitioned out of the church, I don't think you care, right? You're like, yeah, I went and did a psilocybin journey, or I went and, you know, I tried cocaine. Because you don't care as much. But
yeah, that box, it's different. And when you say don't care, and not caring maybe about what leaders have told us, and of making your own decisions and figuring out what's right for us personally.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Thanks for clarifying that for me. Let's see, what is in here? Cocaine, just as a data point, definitely not the first place Mormons go.
That is very expensive.
I wouldn't know, but yeah, I hear that. It was interesting to see how the people that are using it for emotional regulation, they tend to be believing or semi or active members. I don't know why, but people that have transitioned, their need for emotional regulation is lower than people that are still somewhat practicing.
So maybe with at least our respondents, there is some pressure for them, not everyone, but for them with perfectionism, where they might have turned to different things for that regulation.
Or that cognitive dissonance, like, yes, this thing is really helping me, but my bishop's telling me that I shouldn't, right? How do I hold space for both of those things? Creates anxiety, as an example. Mm-hmm. We noticed that believing members are more likely to medicate with socially acceptable things like caffeine or opioids. While we didn't list it, it came up in the other category quite a bit. But if someone was less believing, they were more willing to try things outside of the social norm. At least that's kind of the assumption.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, just my personal experience, this was over 10 years ago when I was at BYU for grad school, but with everything I was doing, I needed caffeine to get through it. So I would find all my creative ways to do it without having coffee, right? Like, and it's just so funny to me to, like, it was probably less healthy than having coffee, but.
Right. Anyway, there's some other bullet points here. Probably don't want to spend too much time on that, but there are some interesting things that came out of that. We'll probably spend a little time on this. Jen, do you want to lead us out on some of these points here?
Yeah, a lot of these are just really interesting. In a Mormon context, growing up, the importance of the word of wisdom is a very big thing that we teach. And it's interesting, this wasn't at the beginning of our church emphasized, but now it is. And it's very much based on this abstinence and never having it. And that if you have it, something once, that it's going to lead to addiction. And growing, like, we weren't really taught a lot maybe about moderation. And so it was a lot of all or nothing thing. So, and learning, learning boundaries. Like, I mean, we're not really taught about how to have boundaries in Mormonism. And I want to make space for people that like maybe have had other experiences and positive experiences too with that. But, you know, even from like having callings, you know, like it's not okay to say no. And these are the rules. And I think that in our own lives, maybe we can, as we develop and as we get older, some of these safeguards, we need to kind of own our own decisions and figure out what's right for us, learn what boundaries we need. At some point, I do want to talk about having, if you're going to use substances, you want to have boundaries around that. You want to maybe have a safety plan even about that. I think that could be really helpful. So yeah, and it's important to have healthy coping skills. So normally we really criticize like substance use as a coping skill. And I think of coping skills kind of more in a way of how much are we using? Do we have moderation? You know what I mean? Like the same thing, like I've had, like, how many times have I binge watched shows that it probably wasn't very healthy. So like, it's more of the amount, you know, like it's healthy to watch like a couple hours of TV. But maybe, you know, watching a ton or for example, having ice cream, like after a long day, it's okay to have ice cream. You know, you probably don't want to have a full gallon, this huge thing and feel sick. So you want to ask yourself, what is bringing me comfort? How am I feeling afterwards? You know, and for some people, maybe having a glass of wine with dinner, maybe having, you know, a drink that could, there can be room for that, with your personal boundaries and your personal values and being consistent with your own, whatever your own values are. Kimberly?
A question from the audience, and I am an audience member, so this is a question from me. Was this survey done pre-COVID? I'm assuming it was. I don't know. And if it was done pre-COVID, do you think the respondents and the data would be differently?
It was done. The first set of answers started coming back, I would say, early March. So most of the survey took place during COVID. If it was done before, I don't know that it would have changed. I think it would have been consistent.
I think this is a good question. In a larger population, I think, especially people that had to stay in their house, and it can be very emotional to social isolate like that. I can definitely see people, especially with alcohol, having more of that. You know, and also there's some people that have certain boundaries about alcohol where they don't have it in their home, that might be regretting that boundary with COVID.
Well, and we saw that social reasons was huge. So if you're limited in your ability to connect socially in ways that you're accustomed to, you might find while the substance exists, your ability to use the substance in the same way is different.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and going back a little bit to like how you use this, if you have a safety plan. I mean, I think with alcohol, in my clinical experience with my clients, and I don't know if data backs this up, but I've seen there's a big difference for people that are just drinking a ton alone at night when they're depressed and what that looks like, and that people that are drinking every once in a while with friends. And even having a connective experience with that. To me, those two feel very different.
So in here, we also have Mormons have a hunger for spiritual experiences. Take the first vision as an example. And we'll talk more about this in a second briefly. But the whole Mormon narrative begins with this majestic, you know, off the chart spiritual experience. We talk about feeling the spirit. So anything that creates a altered state of consciousness or an emotional experience that is tangible, I think is sought after. right? And then, of course, if you've ever heard these stories, and I'm sure everybody has, I went to the temple and my grandma appeared to me and she told me that I should do this or whatever. They're beautiful stories. And I'm not saying they are or are not true, but people want them. And so if there's something that they can do as a tool that helps create them or helps connect with those experiences, I think Mormons versus non-Mormons have a hunger for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And using a tool doesn't make the spiritual experience any less valid.
No, as we will probably note here in a minute. There's a little bit of ecclesiastical conflict, I think, that exists within the Mormon tradition. If I was Episcopalian and I was struggling with some negative impact on how a substance showed up in my life, I probably wouldn't receive the same intervention that I might from my bishop. Now, not always, right? But it's different. So there's a factor there I think worth considering. Jen, you want to comment on some of the other ones here?
Just a comment. And I think we have another slide about that. So I'll save that. We'll talk a little more about bishops. But Kimberly?
Yeah, there's a question that's interesting that kind of ties in with a couple of previous slides. The question is, what's going on? Are there Mormon tour groups going down to South America to do ayahuasca? That's not a very accessible drug. And you can speak to maybe accessibility in North America now.
Yeah, I'll answer that one. So the answer is yes, this is happening. But ayahuasca, and I know this personally, is available locally, not legally. But it's not really heavily policed. So while the legal path would be to head down to Peru or something, and people do this very often, it's also being experienced all around the United States. It just is. I will say, and this is probably a good place to interject this, with most of these drugs, alcohol included, set and setting is really, really important. Mm-hmm. If you're depressed and you drink, what would you expect, Jen?
Okay, so alcohol tends to increase whatever you're currently feeling, you know? So like maybe you're feeling like a lot of love and connection and you have it and that's kind of going to increase. If you're angry, it can increase that, you know? Maybe you might, the filter is not going to be there, you know? Sometimes that might help people share things too. Sometimes it might lead to like an argument, you know, so how you're actually feeling before, but yeah, if you're depressed, it's going to accelerate that.
For sure. And this is true with most of these substances. I'm not going to call myself an expert on all of them because I'm not, but in general, this is what we see across the board. The intention of the individual in the experience sets the tone of that experience. And the more powerful the thing, right, whether it's ayahuasca or psilocybin versus, you know, whatever, right, is going to promote that set and setting in the direction in which it began.
And you can have the best of intentions. And if you're at a really low point, it may not be the time. It may not be helpful.
Right. Yeah, we should probably just mention as we go off of the slide that Mormon communities, maybe this is more of a regional thing, tend to have higher use of anti-anxiety or anti-depression medications. Why that is probably a whole different topic. Nonetheless, is in terms of substance use, there's a demographic footprint in how those things are used.
Yeah. Well, and going back, I don't know if we said anything about like the social rejection, maybe, and I mean, it does affect, we're social creatures, you know, when we have families and friends that might really reject us, we all want to be accepted. That's a basic need. That's going to affect our decisions.
Stronger in a Mormon population, though, especially if you live in Utah, if you were to start talking to your neighbor saying, hey, guys, I did a mushroom trip, you're not going to be looked at in general as a spiritual pioneer. You know, like, well, my kids aren't going to be able to play with your kids anymore because, right?
Right.
This is how it is. Not always a bad thing, just that's how it is. So we've mentioned this one a couple of times. There was a research paper published by Bexted. I'm trying to think what his name, his first name is. I apologize for forgetting. But he and some of his colleagues put together a research paper that, all but short of a smoking gun, suggested that the early Mormon experience had been augmented by the use of some hallucinogenics. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if that's true or not, right? I mean, the Kirkland Temple experience of angels on the temple and everybody had taken the sacrament beforehand doesn't in and of itself suggest that there was something in the sacramental, you know, wine or whatever. But it's interesting. And this paper is fantastic. Here's my takeaway. Whether it's true or not, culturally, at least through the 19th century, it was not uncommon. I think that contemporary Mormons, and this is simply true outside of the church as well, some of these substances are effective tools in promoting very strong and profound spiritual experiences when done correctly, yada, yada, yada. So fantastic paper. This has been explored in Sunstone previously, I believe. So psilocybin, right, that's mushrooms. It actually is illegal in three different jurisdictions, Oakland, California, the Denver city center, and Santa Cruz, California. There's a huge push to legalize psilocybin in other areas as well. Cannabis, as you know, is legal in most states. Here in Utah, where I live, it's available by prescription for a certain subset of medical conditions, although it's a little bit difficult to get it currently, but that's changing. But it's an interesting landscape in terms of the legalization of some of the things we're talking about. It would not surprise me if other substances that we've talked about would become legal. I don't think cocaine's going to be one of them. I could see ayahuasca be included, peyote possibly. MDMA is an example that they're currently doing research on, or the street name is Molly for that drug. They're being used in other areas. So there's research, and the MAPS organization, I think, is probably the pioneer behind that initiative. PTSD, drug addiction, depression, all kinds of psychiatric conditions are being addressed in incredibly interesting success rates. Especially
with PTSD and having like a doctor, you know, give you like a mini dose, having a therapist there, it really can create this place for you to reframe your trauma. Because a lot of times with PTSD, we're re-experiencing the same thing over and over. And to give that a different context, some of these drugs have been shown to be helpful.
For sure. There was one that came up in the other usage. It's a drug called ketamine. Ketamine is a very old anesthetic. And it creates nearly immediate differentiation, meaning that you can, under the use of that particular drug, you can say, oh, that's not me. That's something else. That's a problem that I happen to be experienced, but it's not me. It's not my identity, right? It's a phenomenal drug. And you can do this legally with prescription in a clinical environment. It's interesting. I think there's some trends that are going that way. Okay. So this will be some fun discussion as well. Jen, what do you want to say about this?
Well, I've already talked on this, but learning moderation is important. I think often all of us, it's not just Mormons, have a lot of all or nothing thinking. And in general, using something once is not going to make you an addict. You can have drink in moderation. You can use drugs in moderation. It doesn't mean that your life's going to end. There are a couple drugs that are more problematic and harder to do that. And also there's, you know, I think it's 8 or 9% of people that really maybe can't do that. So you get to own that. I'm not going to own that. You make that decision for yourself. I'm not going to promote use or tell you that you can't ever either.
So, in other words, there's utility in some of these things.
Yeah.
For certain people in the right circumstance. Like I don't, from a mental health perspective, I think that's true. Just as I think there are definitely situations where you probably shouldn't ever. And I would say, as we introduced, there are some substances that you probably should just never, ever, consider.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
I'm going to interject here. I do like the unique gotchas, because as we know in Mormonism, there is a unique gotcha in Section 89, the hot drinks. There's a question that relates to that. I'll read it to you. Could you elaborate on the use of caffeine as it relates to keeping the word of wisdom, and what the importance the source of the caffeine has for, quote, believers?
I could answer that. Jen, you want to take a shot at it?
I'm not sure exactly. I didn't understand the full question. Say it one more time.
Can I slam a Red Bull, or do I take a triple quadruple latte?
How people are using caffeine.
How does the differentiation of the source, does where the source of the caffeine come from make a difference to believing members?
Oh yeah, I think it makes a huge difference on what they're going to use. And it's interesting because it's not always the healthier choice. But yeah, people will have, like 5-hour energy and caffeine pills and all these things. And I don't want to shame people for using that because, I've used those. But they're not any healthier necessarily than the coffee, but yet that's what the rule is. And so it's interesting how we do that. My personality is I always wanted to find a way. I hate rules. So I always had to find a way to work around. And I get that can be that look very problematic. So
it's interesting to see how caffeine evolved as the component in which the word of wisdom is traditionally accepted. I remember being a kid, my parents would not have Coca-Cola in our house, but had no problem with root beer, which may have more sugar, right? Which may be more problematic. And then, it was maybe a year ago that BYU put or allowed Coca-Cola or caffeinated sodas on campus. Why? Then what's the significance? It's interesting to see the evolution. And to our point earlier, as you said, we side skirt, we make exceptions. We do this with alcohol. We do this with everything. We do this with hallucinogenics. It's like, if I can connect with Jesus and I'm using psilocybin, that's okay. But if I use LSD just because I want to take a really cool trip, that's not okay. I don't know that that's always true, because what's okay is very much a cultural imprint of our intention. So kind of fascinating. Anyway, don't want to get too distracted there.
Yeah. Well, and okay, this next bullet point about illegal activity, I will say in Utah, we do have to be very careful with this. Getting charges can affect our careers and stuff. And for example, DUIs, it's much easier to get a DUI in Utah. And so it's important to be very careful about and plan out how. Getting an Uber is way cheaper than getting a DUI. I mean, we're talking about $10,000, that the DUI in Utah, you can serve 10 years in prison.
And DUI doesn't have to be alcohol.
Oh, you're right.
Yes. I think most people would know that, but this is going to sound really horrible. Mormons and substance abuse don't correlate with, what's the word I'm looking for? Adulthood, adulting, right? There's immaturity.
Yeah, we kind of treat everyone like teenagers.
Well, because we act like teenagers. There are, obviously that's a generalization. There's a lot of responsible use, but culturally I think that's true. It's interesting. I think one of the gotchas too is to consider especially if you're a practicing Mormon, but you feel compelled for whatever reason to start using cannabis, maybe for medical reasons, or psilocybin for spiritual enlightenment, your bishop may not agree with your choices. It could negatively impact if you're not careful. It's not a warning. It's just a unique Mormon thing that it could impact your ability to go to the temple and, you know, attend your kid's wedding. Something to think about. Addiction is a gotcha, but it's not the gotcha, I think, that is taught, at least not doctrinally. I don't know. What would you say about addiction, Jen?
In what context?
So I kind of look at addiction. Well, as I grew up in the church, addiction to me was this habit of this unbreakable pattern of dysfunction attributed to a particular substance or behavior, right? That could be pornography. We don't really see clinically, this is true for me, with my clients, I don't typically see addiction. Alcohol is an exception, certainly heroin and crack and stuff like that. But the vast majority of the substances that we're talking about here, they can be habit forming, but addictive is not really a term I would use. But that doesn't mean that they can't be habit forming in some way in that you maybe want to be aware of.
Yeah. Oh, we can definitely, I mean, there's so many drugs that we can create a dependency. I mean, just because you mentioned crack, I hate the way that we are finally our loss of change, but like we used to treat that so much different than cocaine, which is a lot about privilege and racism. And
for sure.
I won't go all into that, but yeah, that's definitely very problematic.
Where to get help? We recognize just as a final slide, and then I think we'll just kind of open up the discussion for some questions. We recognize that it's not a really dangerous minefield, but depending on the situation, some people may need help. When you feel that you might need help, if this fits you, find a competent therapist or doctor. The underlying issue of most substance use dysfunction is not addiction, it's some other thing. So it does take a little bit more expertise, I think, in order to address it.
Yes. In fact, we're finding we used to be such interfield really support AA groups, and that can work wonderfully for people, and I totally value that and support that. But also often that individual therapy of really addressing the underlying issue of why it's become problematic use.
For sure.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's a couple of phone numbers on here, a Utah and a SAMHSA, which is a national helpline for substance use. Should you talk to your bishop? Sure, if it's helpful, right? I mean, that could
there's
be.
There's some great bishops.
Absolutely. And there's a component for many people as an ecclesiastical support. I would say, though, primarily we would not, as mental health providers, not recommend that the bishop be the source of diagnosis and treatment.
No, they are not able to diagnose. They are not able to give therapy. That is not their line,
right?
Like their role. That their role is spiritual, helping you spiritually, and that's going to look a lot different. And so if you're just going to them to try to fix like some emotional issues, it's probably not going to be very helpful.
So some people may or may not, but it's a question to ask, where can you find support within your family if you find yourself
stuck? Make sure that you have safe people that you can turn to. Sometimes those aren't family members.
Yeah, Kimberly?
So we've got about 8 minutes left.
Okay.
Most of the questions I've already kind of been able to weave in here. Thank you for bringing up ketamine. That's a huge one that I'm seeing clinically. And I don't want to jump into my stuff because the session is not about me, but I'm desperate to have a conversation with you two about this from a professional standpoint, because yes, this is great. But I want to mention some comments. Several Hindu mystics were encouraged by Western society's interest in expanded consciousness during the 1960s, but dismayed by the use of psychedelics that many of these Westerners were doing as part of their search for deeper insight and understanding. Just a comment. And that this question then kind of dovetails onto that comment. Are we approaching the use of entheogens in a typical American get it done now fashion, rather than taking a longer, more extended path to deeper light and understanding?
That is appropriately rhetorical, and I think very reflective of the Western attitude towards many things, like just take a pill, done, get it over. But traditionally, it was never used that way. If you were to go to Peru as an example and experience ayahuasca, they just don't, you just don't show up and they give you something that tastes like rotting wood, right? There's prep, right, that you're doing. There's meditation, possibly. The setting of the environment is set up in a spiritual way, traditional or consistent with the traditions of the shamans that you're working with. And it's administrated by shamans, usually. So for sure, there's a bigger experience depending on the intention of the substance use, whether I'm just going to have a glass of wine with friends or I'm going to use psilocybin as a way to connect with the divine. That's bigger than just the thing.
Thank you. Jen, any thoughts about that?
Pretty much he covered it. Yeah.
All right. I guess we had more than, yeah, we have about 10 minutes left in the session. There was a question, and I, since I'm a little bit of a researcher myself, I do want to speak to some of the research methods that this question brings up. He, or this questioner asks, can you speak to coverage and non-response errors and how they affected your findings? Your topic already has a large social desirability bias exacerbated by Mormonism. Any thoughts? Because I have some thoughts just based on the question. It's kind of a, but I'll let you guys answer that about your own study.
First of all, this was not a peer-reviewed study that we can really use to, you know, we wanted to use it to kind of get some information and interest, but this isn't peer-reviewed, and it's not published in any kind of peer-reviewed journal, and so that's very important. I've gone through the rigors of getting something published in that, and it looks a lot different.
I don't think Jen nor I come from a PhD statistical research analysis background.
I did have to get published for my master's degree, but.
Okay, fair enough. So there are some holes, as it were. I think there's some confounding variables that we probably could have isolated more appropriately had we taken the time and had more respondents. I'm not sure the degree that answers that question.
Well, and I do think that it kind of begs, it's somewhat antagonistic in my opinion, the question, but I did want to bring it up just so that you could speak to your research methods. I mean, honestly, it's a self-selecting survey. It's biased towards Mormonism because you were asking Mormons?
Exactly. Okay. In fact, we excluded on purpose just to simplify it, and probably not. I wish we would have had non-Mormons as a comparison.
As your control group, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. But we directly targeted Mormons or had been Mormon at some point.
Right. Comment and kind of a question. We'll roll this together. I've been surprised with how healing/fun/spiritual/emotional/sexual, whew, lots in there. Cannabis has been for me since deciding to partake. Did your survey ask any questions about how people decided to use these substances with all the word of wisdom, shame, and the Mormon stuff that comes up?
We didn't really go into shame. We did go into like the purposes of people using. I think there's a lot of healing value. And a lot of these drugs, especially marijuana. I'm hopeful that that will become legal. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the substances, I'm trying to find the exact chart, and I may not have published it in this PowerPoint. I think it's right here. Nope, it's not right there. Yes, right here. Cannabis is interesting. Like, unlike hallucinogenics that have a focus around spiritual enlightenment intent, cannabis is a broad spectrum. Like, people use it for all kinds of stuff. Is that because it's widely available in most areas, or is it because it has a lot of general application? I don't know. What I hear from clients that use cannabis in some form covers the gamut. Physical ailment, emotional regulation, recreation and fun, even spiritual
pain. I mean, if you're dealing with cancer, the benefits of this, you can actually eat. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of positive.
But very much unlike tobacco. Tobacco, now it's pretty much just for fun, right? Or some amount of just controlling anxiety, but it's not spiritual. Cocaine, yeah, it's just because it what it does for me. Alcohol, very strong social bent. Hallucinogenics, as I mentioned, but no, cannabis is right across the board. It's pretty consistent. It does it all. At least that's why people think it does it all.
Some people, interesting, have used meth for sex to increase that. That normally doesn't work long term.
Well, MDMA.
I have some clients use that.
MDMA does that. So MDMA is, or Molly, is a really strong, if we go back to mechanism of action, which we didn't really spend a whole lot of time on that, more serotonin, dopamine, yeah, you're probably going to have a stronger sexual experience. I don't have any experience with it, but I am aware that is the case.
Thanks, you guys. I have a lot to say about cannabis, but again, this will be private. I just came from California working clinically where it's legal, and we've got the whole range of CBD, THC, oil, smokables, vapables, you know, everything. And I have
and a lot of people are using the legal oil and finding mm-hmm. a lot of benefits of that here.
Right. And a lot of Mormons in California are finding that CBD is great if it has just a little bit of THC in there. Compounding effect. Okay, but here is a question. We've got about 4 minutes left. You may clear up some of the roles of a therapist in the answering of this question. How widespread is the availability of therapists who can assist in a psilocybin trip? How does one find them?
Great question.
That's a very good question.
It depends where you live.
Yes, completely. We have to be very careful with our licenses to make, because some therapists can do this and some can't.
Yeah, yes. If you are in Oakland, Denver, or Santa Cruz, California, you're going to have no problem finding therapists who hopefully have been trained in the use of that clinically. Outside of those areas, nearly every therapist should probably be telling you, do it safe, come back and we'll talk about it, but they don't combine the two.
Yeah, and it's not a therapist normally telling you to use it. It's just, this is your decision,
yeah,
and let's process it.
No therapist has you can't script it. You know, yeah, exactly. You need to go do this. I'm going to recommend it as part of your treatment plan. You're probably not going to hear that.
Yeah, no.
And I've made a lot of treatment plans, and I've never had any psychotropic medication thrown in there. Okay, so.
But I will say really quick, I have had clients say, I did this. Yes. Can we process through my experience?
Definitely.
That happens all the time.
Powerful.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah, very helpful.
Quickly, this may be more related to shame, but did you address respondents keeping their substance use closeted from family and friends due to it being so taboo within Mormonism?
Not directly, but indirectly it came out. So we noticed that the people that were had a blended activity level or blended belief were more socially reluctant to use substances for, I think, that very reason. The shame, it's pervasive. But if they're out, right, they transitioned out of the church and activity, they don't care. They're good. And they don't have a problem with it. It doesn't negatively impact their life.
Awesome. Thank you. And that's kind of what I was reading between the lines of that data, kind of teasing that out. The last question, and I think we probably should end. Have you seen the recent study published in the journal Tel Aviv, which showed that cannabis was used on ancient altars in the kingdom of Judah, suggesting that it was used as part of their ritual worship in the Israelite temples?
The answer is yes. It's interesting, but I'm going to riff on that and say substances like ayahuasca, the DMT is the mechanism of action chemically, shows up in more than one plant and also has some historical representation that dates all the way back to Egypt and different flora. Why? I don't know, but it exists for sure.
Yeah. So it seems like, yeah, if there was spiritual benefits.
I would love to find a little deeper study that talked about the enhanced spiritual component that psychotropic or psychedelics could be used amongst active members actively seeking out higher spiritual planes within accepted and non-shaming, non-taboo religious ceremony and ritual. I don't know that that's there. I don't know if you'd get a sample size to do it.
I think we love that.
Yeah,
if there's interest, I think that there's a lot we can expand on from this and talk about it more next year. Yeah.
Jeff, Jen, it has been lovely meeting you, Jeff. Lovely seeing you again, Jen. On behalf of Sunstone and Lindsay and Grace and Stephen and all the gang that's involved in putting this thing on, thanks for volunteering to participate and present. And thank you to everyone who attended. In the end, we ended up with 38 attendees. So well done, guys. Thanks to everybody.